while there's a lot going on in terms of the practical aspects of making progress in AI programming and data sets and whatnot, I'm interested in the philosophical dimension, both cosmology, what does it tell us about cosmology, and also social science, what is the impact on society, and mind science, the inner being, because there are implants coming. And so what is the significance of that? What will be the boundary between a human and a non-human? What does it even mean to be human? You have to ask these questions bravely. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't find our gurus asking these questions. I don't find them even acknowledging the question. They kind of divert and shirk, and they have a very superficial understanding. And I've talked to all kind of gurus. I don't want to name anyone. I respect them a lot for what they do, but they are not up to the mark and current with the actual understanding of AI to be able to engage it. So that you can give a trivial answer to a profound question, and that's no good. So from our tradition, I don't see enough leadership where it should come from, and it should come from the gurus. But I do see this from other traditions, especially the Judeo-Christian tradition. I see a lot of involvement with AI, the ethical questions, the theological questions, spiritual questions. And so I'm trying to ignite that interest, and I will try to raise some questions for you. The first provocation is, you know, do we understand the relationship between consciousness and intelligence? In the five battlegrounds that I mentioned in my book, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power, five battlegrounds. One of the most important battlegrounds, probably my favorite one, is the battleground on consciousness, on this whole field of, the question of, is an intelligent entity conscious? And I would say no. I have had this discussion with Subhash Kak, and I respect him a lot. I've had a discussion with a lot of people who the AI field subscribes to this idea called singularity. When the machine will become like, surpass humans, because it will have enough intelligence, and it will be able to not only pass the Turing test, but it'll be able to be like a human being in terms of all its behavior. And there is this artificial general intelligence, AGI, which is the point when, you know, machines can do all kind of things like humans can do. But my pushback to that is that no amount of intelligence, even more intelligent than human behavior, constitutes consciousness. A self-driving car is not conscious, but its intelligent behavior can be better than a human driver. It is behaving intelligently. If I look at the car driving and it's really smart, the way it drives, makes decisions, stops, starts, and doesn't have accidents, as an observer, I would say this is more intelligent than the human drivers. But it is not a conscious machine. It is not conscious. So I can give you so many examples that intelligent behavior, what basically is artificial intelligence is the substitute for humans or augmentation for human intelligence with a machine or with an algorithm. So this algorithmic behavior, which a bystander or somebody who's engaged with this device will consider very, very intelligent, does not require as a prerequisite that this entity has to be conscious. An unconscious, totally unconscious entity can be intelligent. In fact, in our body, there is a lot of intelligent activity going on that we are not conscious of. We are not necessarily conscious that our heart is beating, and how the blood is moving and how the digestion is happening and all the metabolism going on and all the things happening inside each cell. We're not conscious of it. But unconscious intelligence exists. So there is something called unconscious intelligence, which could be one part of that could be the artificial intelligence. So you can have intelligence without consciousness, without being conscious of it. And the system may not have any capability of being conscious, and it yet could be very intelligent. The other way around also, you could be conscious and not very intelligent. I know some conscious people who are quite stupid. I know stupid people. And so if a person is stupid or unintelligent, he's still conscious. I mean, you could have a real duffer. You could have a person who sort of got hardly any much intelligence, but could be very conscious. So you can have consciousness without intelligence, and you can have intelligence without consciousness. I've given you some evidence of that. And so that means you cannot really put these in the same camp. And it's a major mistake in this field to think of consciousness as a very advanced form of intelligence. It's not. It's got nothing to do with it. I mean, you could have a little teeny thing that is conscious, and whether it is very intelligent or not is a separate issue. Okay. And you could have something exceedingly intelligent, and whether it is conscious or not is a separate issue. So I wanted to, first of all, differentiate these two in my way of thinking. And then I want to talk about on a micro level and a macro level. On a micro level, with implants able to measure our emotion, am I angry? Am I likely to get violent? What is the neural pattern that corresponds to somebody about to have a big problem, heart attack, or you know, whether it is monitoring my biochemistry, whether it is monitoring some strange mental behavior, the recognition of patterns of neurons, even though the machines don't understand the pattern of neuron is too complex, but the machines are able to, with AI, correlate a particular pattern with a particular likely outcome, probability-wise, that when this pattern happens, Rajiv is likely to get into this kind of a problem. Or he, you know. So this ability to do that means that there is some value in implants, and this is going to be a very, very massive industry. I'm not talking about futuristic. It is coming this decade, in the next few years. Implants that serve the purpose of able to evaluate, predict. And then the question is, okay, once you've predicted that this guy is going to get violent, or he's going to about to, have a cardiac problem or something, then the question is, do you intervene? How do you intervene? Do you bring an ambulance? Do you bring the police? Or is there also intervention possible? So there are two parts to it. One is the detection and pattern recognition through AI, and the other is intervention. They are two separate fields, related, of course. So this business of implants means that it raises another issue. Now you have augmented my conscious behavior, augmented. It doesn't mean that it is conscious by itself, but it is augmenting my conscious behavior. It may be suppressing my anger. It may be put in something to say, okay, this guy is about to get violent. I better do some intervention and change the neural behavior and bring in an alternative neural pattern so that this guy will be very happy and relaxed. Maybe that sort of thing. So it is not being conscious by itself, but able to interact with my consciousness, enhance it, suppress it, maybe dumb down people, turn them into people who will be complicit, compliant. They will obey the laws. They will go into very dangerous territory without being scared, because you want them to. Maybe they will not disobey. Maybe they will not misbehave. Maybe a prison sentence. Instead of the judge sending you somebody to prison for violence, he will say, okay, you got to have this implant, and it'll monitor you and keep you okay. So this human machine unified entity providing a different kind of behavior is a very that not just plausible, but it is kind of inevitable that this is the direction we're going to. So in the field of mind sciences, which has been a field of mine for a while, I find this a very intriguing thing. What is the philosophical implications of implants, especially as they, what are the ethical implications and also philosophical implications? How much of the mind can be mapped and modeled as an algorithm? How much of the mind is algorithmic? This is a question, very important question. And what is left of the mind beyond the algorithmic mind? Is there a mind beyond the algorithm, which is what we say is our Atma, is beyond the Buddhi? So if they can model all the levels of intelligence, but there is the consciousness which is above it, which is providing some functionality, that issue, I think, is going to become put on the front burner because of the advances of AI. AI is going to force the scientists now to come to terms with the interface and the boundaries and the distinctiveness, this distinction between conscious and intelligent functions. So when we talk about what machines will take over, and we are saying that AI will take over more and more of this and that, then the pushback is, some people say, well, but you know, the machine is not conscious, so it cannot take back creativity. So the question is, what is creativity? What is creativity? And is there is a large part of creativity possible with AI without being conscious? And of course, AI is developing. There are AI systems that are developing poetry and music and painting, which are creative functions. And learning to do it in such a way that judges cannot tell the difference between which one is done by a human and which one is done by an AI. Judges cannot tell the difference with the poetry and say, this poetry must be done by a machine, or this particular painting, or this particular piece of music. Judges cannot tell. So if judges cannot tell, if human judges who are experts cannot tell, then that's pretty darn good. Okay, so what we are pushing this border of where is human consciousness necessary. We're saying that you cannot just make anymore say all creativity is beyond machines, and all creativity, all original thinking is beyond machines, because machines are also doing things we consider creative. So therefore, the boundary of creativity beyond algorithm, non-algorithmic creativity, has not been defined. We don't know how far this can go on. But we do know from the Vedic point of view, there is an Atman which is different, separate, above the Buddhi. So this is where the Sankhya model comes in of Purush. I believe that the Sankhya Purush cannot be artificially made. That's the premise I have. We can argue later if you guys want. But I start with the premise that the Purush of Sankhya cannot be replicated. But the Prakriti is at the level at which AI functions. Making Prakriti organized and behave more intelligently is fine. Sankhya doesn't say that Prakriti has to be dumb. But the role of the Purush is indispensable in our model, that the model I subscribe to. And so the question is, how far can Prakriti advance by being reorganized in silicon and with algorithms and more data sets and learning and all that? How far can Prakriti advance in terms of its capability and intelligence, equaling humans, superseding humans? Okay, how far can it advance on its, by itself? And where is the border going to be that says, okay, here is a hard border? Is there a hard border? Is there a bound? Is there an upper limit to artificial intelligence? Because beyond that, is the functionality of Purush, and you can never replace that. So this is a question in mind sciences. And this is a question where I'm very disappointed with my fellow travelers in mind sciences. Many Western scientists in neuroscience, philosophy, I have interacted with, gone to conferences, debated, argued for 25, 30 years now. We used to sponsor the Tucson. In Tucson, there is a consciousness studies conference every 2 years. There used to be a journal of consciousness studies. There were so many. There's transpersonal psychology. There is integral yoga, integral theory, all kind of things that I got involved in many, many years ago. And I was very impressed that these people were basically spiritual and trying to look at the whole issue in that way. But with the advancement of AI, many of them have flipped. Many of them have actually gone into this different philosophical mode where, you know, even consciousness can be a phenomenon of, mechanical phenomenon. They have gone into that. So that's really what in consciousness studies is called the hard problem. Hard problem is, how do you explain consciousness? That's the hard problem in consciousness studies field. And so this is a Western field, but a lot of Indian input has been there, and they don't acknowledge the Indian input, but there is a lot of Indian input there. They've borrowed a lot from the Indian thought, and I'm writing volumes on this, on the unacknowledged contributions of Indian thought in the Western consciousness studies field. So the people were very respectful whether they called it Indian, Vedic, whether they called it Christian, they Christianized it, whether they called it something else, they came up with their own terms for it, whatever they called it, they were very respectful that there is this thing, entity called consciousness that cannot be, you cannot be reductionist and bring it down to mechanistic behavior. They were very much into that. But many of these big names have flipped. And so they have now started going into, because they're so impressed by what AI can do, that now they have lost hope or lost faith in a higher state called consciousness. So this is a bit troubling to me. But that's, you know, everybody has to choose their own sort of where they come out on this. So I want to also talk about cosmology. Mind sciences is the microcosm. There's a cosmology, and I'm writing a whole book on you know, question is the cosmos algorithmic? Is the cosmos algorithmic? Now, you cannot say no, because the laws of physics are algorithmic. How electron behaviors is, you can write an algorithm that will tell you how this tree will grow when you put up, you know, if you know all the conditions, environmental conditions, biologists can tell you how, what will happen. It can predict. The ability of science to build a model and predict is because a large part of nature, if not all of it, a large part of nature is algorithmic. And therefore, it lends itself to this kind of thinking. So the question is, when you say, is the cosmos algorithmic? It has to say yes, but not only yes. The question is not, the doubt is not over whether a large part of the cosmos is algorithmic, because it is. That's the success of science. But is there something beyond the algorithmic part of the cosmos? That is the real question. Is there also a non-algorithmic part to the cosmos? And that goes back to this microcosm, mind science issue. Is there an Atma or none? And in the conscious, in the cosmic sense, it is. Is there a huge consciousness? Is there a consciousness? And then if there is a consciousness, which I believe, then what is its relationship with the cosmos, algorithmic cosmos? And then you end up with the nirgun, sagun, brahman. You end up with the conscious level, and then the mechanistic manifestation. So I'm writing a lot on this. This is what I wanted to share with you. I'm writing a lot on these kind of issues that I've just been talking about, both at the macro level and at the micro level, and the relationship between these two. Now, since there is very little time, I'll just summarize I have many things to talk about, but maybe we'll do it some other day. I'm also concerned about the societal level of AI not being grounded in Vedic premises. The underlying neural network model is not Sankhya. It's a mechanistic model. And I don't want to get into it much, but I'm building a whole Vedic model of AI, a whole Vedic model in which things will be, the entire philosophical approach will be different. And I intend to write some stuff on this. So we know there is bias. If you look at the problem from the society side, we know there's bias in all these social media. You try and get away with something and it'll reprimand you or do some shadow banning or throw you out or whatever. Whereas people on the opposite side get away with it. And there is this clear bias because the algorithms have been trained on Wikipedia and New York Times and various type of Western liberal wokism kind of frameworks and data sets. So its behavior is mirroring the training. I mean, if you take a child and put him in a Catholic convent or put him in a madrasa or put him in a Maoist academy or put him in a Gurukul, it will be different. The outcome will be different depending on the environment and the data set and the syllabus of training. So the algorithms have been trained. What I would consider to be the liberal left-wing ideology has been used to train all these algorithms. Okay, and now like there is ChatGPT from the Western side, there is also Falcon as an example. It comes out of Qatar government. They funded Al Jazeera as a media, very sophisticated, And now they've developed something called Falcon, which is an AI, like a ChatGPT competitor, doing extremely well. And it's going to be trained on Arabic sources, Arabic data sets, Islamic data sets. So I've gone to so many gurus and said, why don't we have a Vedic AI? Why don't we have that? Why aren't you guys funding it? I'll lead the project. I need resources. I would love to do this. And, you know, they don't even know what the problem is. They don't even know what I'm bothered about. They think, oh, now they're philosophizing and trivializing the problem. But this is a serious problem that in the future narrative debates that people like us have been fighting for decades, the future debate of narratives is going to be highly influenced by AI models, because the power of the AI to take over conversations, shape policies, put in fake stuff, control social media, that power is so huge and getting more and more so. And human beings are not the ones who are going to be gatekeepers deciding, you know, should we let in this guy's view or that guy's view, and whom do we reprimand and whom do we shut down, and what is truth and what is not truth, is going to be decided by algorithms. And these algorithms are, trained. And so who is training them makes a big difference. So this is a field of AI bias. Now, if you look into large language models are not Sanskrit friendly. And this is something I want to ask Girish Jha what he thinks of it. We need to do Sanskrit tokenization. That is the AI term, tokenization, which means the smallest building blocks in the AI. Okay, what are the smallest building blocks in the AI? And there we need to put in Sanskrit rules that if you have this particular sound and this particular sound and you combine them, how do they make a new sound? And if you have a sound, how do you break it into two separate sounds? And when is it that when you put two sounds together, they don't merge? And when do they merge? All the rules of Panini, when you look at it, a kind of tokenization based on that would be very different from the large language models we have. So not only is there a problem of biased data sets being used to train, but underneath the thing, the basic level building blocks of the AI are from systems of thinking, which are not our system of thinking. Let me just say it this way. And I wrote a book called Sanskrit Non-Translatables, which is out there. You can read it. It's done very well, where I'm arguing why there are certain words and sounds and syllables of Sanskrit that do not have an English meaning. And it's a mistake to translate them. It's a mistake because the moment you translate them, you've lost what is unique about your tradition. The preservation of our Sankhya and other philosophies is dependent on the non-translatable Sanskrit words which are used. I mean, if you translate Purusha something in the Western cosmology and Prakriti and whatnot, it's a mistake. You cannot translate Buddhi. You cannot translate these things. You cannot translate Prana as breath. It is not. Because breath, even a machine can be breathing, heart-lung machine can be breathing, but it is not doing pranayam. So you see, we have become colonized and digested in such a deep way that we're not even taking it seriously. And this is the final battle. If we lose this battle, which currently we are losing, there is really nothing left of our civilization. There's nothing left of the Vedic civilization, because the whole thing, from the Sanskrit to the thoughts to everything, is being mapped onto Western substitutes. And then we can be put in a museum. Museum, because we're no longer relevant, we're no longer needed. Everything that was useful has been taken and mapped onto something Western. And so the original is just meant for a few people like you guys who can study for fun, and maybe you can study it out of intellectual curiosity, but there is no practical use anymore. That is where we are headed, unless we can do the kind of things, the kind of investigation and the kind of things I've just talked about. So I want to stop here, and because, you know, this is a very big subject, and I do want to come out with some books on this subject, and then we can have more fun. But meanwhile, I just want to thank you for inviting me. And if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take them. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rajiv, for a wonderful talk. And you have a lot of experience, actually, the core AI, and now also talking about AI and the challenges that AI brings. And talking about Sanskrit and the tokenization issues, Sanskrit happens to be the most complicated language in terms of tokenization, because you rightly pointed out, it's a challenge. because a single word can run into several pages. The biggest word, perhaps, in human history would be a word in Kadambari, which runs into 37 pages. So, classifying would be a challenge. And also the corpora that Sanskrit would provide you on internet is not from the same period. Yeah, most of the classical texts from different periods. The current Sanskrit would be of a different kind, and the classical Sanskrit would be a different kind. Vedic would be a different kind. So creating a large language model from a single Sanskrit is a challenge too. So you have to have a significant number of sentences from each kind of Sanskrit. I was creating a predictive keyboard for Sanskrit for SwiftKey as part of a consultancy. I was trying to crawl corpora and maybe then predict words, the next word you're going to type. And I found some contemporary Sanskrit data for approximately 100,000 word corpora. And I was creating a frequency list of words, and I found about 23,000 unique words in 100,000 word corpora. Because of the innumerable inflections that a noun can undergo in Sanskrit, and verbs can undergo in Sanskrit. And approximately there are 102 billion possibilities of tokens in Sanskrit. The independent tokens. And if you combine them into, a collocation, samasa, et cetera, there'll be, I don't know how many would be there. And mind you, there are 2,000 verb roots in Sanskrit. In Pani Dhatu part, only 500 are actually currently used, were used for Sanskrit. So approximately 1,500 were used for other languages, were contemporary, maybe some of the Prakrits. So thank you, Rajiv, for a very, incisive talk and defining many of the things and bringing Sanskrit closer to Veda. And you are proposing a Vedic model of AI, and then Atman and Buddhi, Atman above Buddhi, and Prakriti being closer to AI, and the future of the immediate future of talking about AI implants and predicting some of the human behavior. All of that are very fascinating and very interesting. With permission from the chair, can we now open the talk to some of the
Can I give a little comment on what Girish said? He made a lot of sense. He made some very important points. Can I just make a quick comment?
Sure.
So I think, and this is a topic we can get into offline sometime if you're interested. But my feeling is that quantum computing will open the possibility of Sanskrit tokenization. Because otherwise, as you pointed out, there's 102 billion combinations here, there, and whatnot. I mean, even though AI is so massive and the computing part is so huge, and they're talking about trillions of terms and whatnot that these guys have put in there, and so massive data sets. But still, that is all based on the English tokenization, which is tiny. And so you need a different scale. And my feeling is that some of these challenges we'll be able to meet with quantum computing. But I'll just leave it as a thought and as a comment, and would love to take more questions.
Even word to vector is a possibility we can solve as a concept. Yeah.
Thank you.
We can take some quick questions.
Pratibha has a question. Pratibha, you can put it in the chat box, or you can unmute yourself.
Yes, actually, I have a question from Dr. Malhotra. When in the beginning of his talk, he talked about a person who was conscious. He was intelligent, but not conscious, or was it? Yeah. I think that was it. So I wanted to know how he sees the differentiation or something like that.
So, okay, this is a very good question. If you read, I think it's chapter 5 of my book, either 5, 4 or 5, but I think it's kind of 5. Go to the book, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power. It's also available on Kindle, and I can send you a copy if you give me an address.
Sure.
That whole chapter, if you write to me offline, I'll send you the thing. That whole chapter is on this very issue. But in a nutshell, basically, intelligent behavior is how others see it. When we study linguistics, we have first person, second person, and third person, right? First person is when I'm saying something about myself, this first person. I have a sense of self. I have a sense of who I am. That's first person. Second person is like we're interacting right now on video or in person. I, you, we are having a conversation. And third person is I'm thinking and reflecting about concepts, about ideas, and so on. That's third person speech. Now, a machine does not have the first person. It does not have the sense of me, mine, self, that idea of selfhood is not there. Mm-hmm. But the machine can fake a conversation with somebody else, second person. It can behave second person so well that you don't know if it's a machine or a person. And certainly a machine can spit out an article or a thesis on some third person issue, some problem you give it, it can solve it. That's a third person issue. So the differentiator of, this is my book, the differentiator of consciousness is having first person, and machines don't have a first person. So that is something you cannot put in a complicated silicon logic and algorithm and say, okay, now this machine has a first person. That won't happen. That's the position I'm taking.
And so how do you define that first person?
The first person is the ability, the self-consciousness, which the interesting thing is I cannot tell whether you are faking or whether you are really have first person. Because when you talk to me, it's second person. So from your second person behavior, I cannot tell whether you really have a first person. If I ask you a question, how are you feeling? You can say, I'm sad. That doesn't mean that you really have this idea of sadness in you.
Okay.
Making it up. So this is the problem of this is the problem of self-consciousness. Verifiability of self-consciousness is not there. So I cannot verify if Girish Jha is really a person or whether he's a robot. He cannot verify that about me, because that first person experience, by definition, only the person himself knows.
So Pratibha, we want to move on to a few other people who have questions, and we have very little time.
Yeah.
Should I expect a question?
Ritu, if you want to go ahead with a very quick question.
Who, me? Thank you. Thank you for your lecture, Professor. I've been thinking on the same lines, and I would like to ask you, by giving a disclaimer that I am not an expert of sciences, but I have done a little bit of philosophy. And on that lines, I would like to ask you that, do you then believe the nature of consciousness being all pervading, and even in the matter and the Vedantic metaphysics is a kind of limited in that sense? In Sankhya philosophy's metaphysics explains AI on more logical grounds, in the sense that we can relate sattva with the intelligence. Sattva is self-revealing, the guna, the pure form of it, that we can correlate with AI. But purushas are limited, and only we are incorporated of those. What do you think about this idea?
Well, this is a very long discussion, but you know, the place I go to, the place I go to a lot, for this whole distinction between consciousness, how the super consciousness, how the one supreme being manifests, the place to go to is the manifestation of the supreme being into matter. So that while the matter cannot be something different, but it is a particular form of consciousness where it is not self-aware. And then the evolution. So the Vivekananda calls it involution. So if you look up Vivekananda's collected works, involution, not evolution, but involution, involution of consciousness as matter, and then in matter. And then Sri Aurobindo takes up the word involution because he considered Vivekananda to be his guru, although in person he never met, but he met in his mind, in his imagination, he had a darshan. So Sri Aurobindo took this idea, Vivekananda's opening idea of involution, into a very, very big field. And that is where you will get a lot of insights.
Thank you.
All right,
Rajiv,
Professor. Thank you for your answer.
And Zairu, we have very little time. So if you have a very quick question.
I'll definitely, sir. Thank you so much. My question is very much related with what Ritu has said, that consciousness, when we talk about how could you differentiate consciousness from matter? Like Sankhya school of thought aptly said that they are totally different thing. They are totally different entities, matter and consciousness. And you also made a very important point that Prakriti is completely dumb. It doesn't have consciousness. So how would you explain the nature with growth and all that, and how computer sciences explain it? As we understand that consciousness has a degree, and everything is conscious in this universe, but degree matters. So how would you reflect on that? Thank you, sir.
So this is the same thing I mentioned just about involution. The model I have started is the whole idea of involution, evolution, from Vivekananda to Sri Aurobindo and so forth. And I think AI is a way to extend that even further. So when you look at it that way, consciousness, there is one consciousness that makes a choice to downgrade itself into in unconscious matter, space, time, causation, limit itself. It's self-limiting. It's like it's not some evil force or outside. There's no duality. There's no outside entity that came and limited the consciousness and said, okay, now you in this electron form or as a cloud or as matter, you won't be conscious. It is its own self-limiting from its own choice. So this chosen limited form becoming matter, dead matter, not life. While it is consciousness only, but it has made that choice to be in this form. This is a view very powerfully explained both by Vivekananda and Sri Aurobindo. So I would say that if you were to go into that detail, I can send you a bunch of references also. I have a whole book out on this coming into this whole area of a Vedic theory of evolution, involution, evolution, and the rise of intelligence and the limits of intelligence. And of course, if you start from the Vedic side and then take it to all the way to AI, it makes a lot of sense. Problem is today people are doing the reverse. They're taking AI as the bench, as the foundation, and trying to make sense of consciousness and trying to figure out how to map religion and all the spirituality into an AI model. I think it's wrong. This is just my take, that we have to start with the Vedic foundation, and you will find that there are amazing insights on how to understand AI. AI is a new phenomenon for sure. It is not this self-learning algorithm that keep learning on its own, keep figuring out and learning on its own, replicates living entities very well, because living entities also keep learning, you know, little from a child, human child, or an animal, or even a virus keep learning from its behavior. A virus keep trying different things and experiments, and what works, then it becomes a mutation. So this thing about AI is a very big breakthrough in humankind to develop a system that is self-learning. And how you can have a continuum of one seamless philosophy, I think the Vedic foundation is absolutely amazing. And that is what the field that I'm working on now, and will be glad to interact more with anybody who contacts me.